All right. I am Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Appett, and our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World. Originally, we were going to do a full episode tonight. We had Jay Ponte, who's going to come on to talk about his book, Be the Revolution, and particularly some of the stuff in there about QAnon and Trump and neo-fascism. I think it'd be really interesting. He actually got a chance to, he's going to be on, I think, a radio show with Stephen Donziger tonight. So it's very understandable that he pushed it back. We'll have that this week. But it kind of works out. So for one thing, as we were planning this, I'm actually feeling a little bit better now, but I was feeling a little sick. So I'm just as happy to not do a full show tonight. But for another thing, we actually have a huge announcement tonight. So this is, even though mostly, you know, we're going to watch a couple shorts, but this is, you know, this is a mostly just going to be a Q&A stream from the chat. We haven't done one of those in a while. But yeah, we have some really good news to share. So this is a, you know, this, it's always been a little frustrating that, you know, this is a small independent channel. And, you know, I think we've been able to have some really amazing guests over the years. Everybody from, you know, Slavoj Žižek to Sam Cedar to Glenn Greenwald to, you know, all sorts of people have been on over the years. I think we've had some really great discussions. I think we have a lot to say, but at the end of the day, it's a small and affiliated show. And that definitely, you know, that definitely limits our reach, which is frustrating. And so we actually recently got an offer to have the show be picked up by a network that is going to really dramatically increase our reach. And I honestly couldn't be more excited about it. Now, I know that there is going to be controversy about this, that some of our core audience is going to be happy that the network that's picking us up is the Daily Wire. And I know what people are going to say, but I'd really ask you to think about, you know, what this is going to mean in terms of the audience and what it's going to mean in terms of how we can continue to get our message out.
Yeah. I mean, we're obviously going to catch a lot of flack for this, but at the end of the day, I mean, no matter what you say, no matter what you do, you're going to have haters. And at the end of the day, resources are resources. And, we don't always have the most resources here. And I think for anyone that's going to start, like, you know, yapping in the comments, start hating, like, think about the fact that there are pledges for me and Andy to make per year. I don't want to give the exact numbers, but it's over six figures.
You know, yeah, so
this is life-changing money. And the resources that we're going to have to actually produce the show that we want to produce, I think, it's really going to be worth it.
No, exactly. And honestly, I've always been really frustrated that the show doesn't have the resources to pay you guys more of a living wage. And so I think there's actually a sense in which this brings us closer into conformity with our core values to be able to do this. And yeah, that's something that I would really ask, you know, the haters in the comments to think about, right? Is their commitment to labor rights there? And I know, I mean, I've seen, like, every time, you know, I say something or don't say something that, you know, people expect or don't expect me to say. Everybody, it's always a big conspiracy theory. You know, everybody's a grifter. Everybody's a sellout, you know. But this is not, you know, nothing that any kind of political evolution I might or might not have is totally unrelated to this. This is something that happened organically.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, it actually started when I was visiting my sister. Her husband's a youth pastor, and I was moved by the Spirit of Christ, and I felt a hand on my shoulder praying with me, and I look over, and it was Stephen Boring.
Well, Jeremy Boring.
Jeremy Boring. Sorry, yeah. Jeremy Boring, yes.
Yeah. No. And this is the
this is all very new. We could at least get the guy's name right if he's
I actually feel a little embarrassed as we're beginning this partnership. But you know,
he's actually cool with me calling him Stephen.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. I didn't know that. But yeah, I mean, my own discussions with Ben, you know, and Ben and Jeremy, right, co-owners of the Daily Wire, you know, since that meeting at the church have been really good. I mean, I have, I was worried that it was going to be an issue that, you know, that we've said so many, you know, really pretty harsh things about them over the years. I mean, we have, I'll cop to that. Right. But it really isn't going to be, like, actually they have a sense of humor about it, you know, like they've seen a lot of the material that we've done, you know, Ben, Shapiro, and, you know, Jeremy Boring, you know, have been, they've all taken on in stride. They're pros, you know,
they got a kick out of other Ben, right? That we call him other Ben. They actually laughed about that. I mean, Ben, yeah, for all, he could laugh at himself. The guy can laugh at himself for sure.
No, exactly. Right. Yeah. And I'll say there's been, like, you know, ideological give and take, because as we're talking about those bits, you know, they, you know, I mean, they did, like, again, they took it in stride. They had a sense of humor about it. And, you know, and they're not demanding that we stop thinking what we think. Like, they're actually committed to ideological diversity. But I will say they did make some good points, right? There was some, you know, there's some real give and take. There were things I've learned from those conversations. And I now feel that I have evolved on certain things, right? Like, I think Israel has a right to defend itself. So, you know, I really think a lot of the things I've been saying nonstop for the last several months are a little out of line. I think that free markets really do deliver, you know, a lot of good for a lot of people. I think that, you know, marriage is the foundation of society, and what were we supposed to say about this? All right. I got the, I was in the bit right up until I was trying to come up with what I was going to say to justify the gay marriage position, but like, I think I'm out.
I agree. If we had yarmulkes, if we all had yarmulkes, that would have been.
I should actually be wearing a yarmulke for this. That would be so much better. But
yeah.
We talked about doing a 2-hour version of this. So for those of you who are mad, just know that this is the compromise position. You are almost going to get 2 hours of right wing.
No, there was actually a discussion of like, okay, do we have like a left wing video we could like comment on from the perspective of the bit. But I actually did correctly predict. I actually underestimated myself a little bit. I was like, I think I can maintain this for about 5 minutes. But I think we actually got a good 8 minutes in before I stopped. Yeah. But yes, April Fools, obviously. The show is not going to be affiliated with the Daily Wire. It's funny that you mentioned Brianna Wu. Because I did have a bit of a follow-up with her today, which we will be getting into shortly. There's also a little bit of follow-up from the Nathan Destiny episode, but I should say the main thing we want to do with the shortened, you know, not quite episode tonight is do a Q&A stream. So if you do have questions related or not to this exciting new partnership with the Daily Wire, I actually do feel like, I mean, obviously we're like telegraphing it a lot with the sartorial choices and the everything, but like, I actually feel like we were committed to it just about well enough that I could almost imagine somebody being like, you know, who is like half paid attention while the, you know, while the show is on behind them or something, and be like, maybe wait, what? Right. Like, I think right up until the hand of Jesus, like it's like, you could just be going to the church to make your sister happy. Right. I mean, come on.
It was time to let them.
That's actually fair.
I'm glad that somebody caught the PMC aspirationalism of wearing my alma maters. I came to the pre-show and I saw Andy dressed like that, and I was dressed like my normal casual ass self, and I was like, this isn't gonna cut it. So I had to scrounge together the costume department. How can I just telegraph douchey conservatism? And like, this is actually not very far from something that I would wear, but I would not wear my alma mater hat along with this outfit. I think that would be a bridge too far for sure.
I was going to I mean, like originally when I was just like, you know, whatever, I finished exercising, I showered, I was getting dressed. I was going to just put on an Iron Maiden shirt. Cause it's like, oh yeah, sure. Whatever. Right. And I was like, no, that's silly. You can't announce a Daily Wire partnership wearing an Iron Maiden shirt. Like, so gotta have something that's like, so I was going to like half commit to it. I was like, okay, this is recognizably how I dress, but I've at least got a button down shirt. I like Andy's choice. No, like this, like just fucking go for it.
Yeah. Andy really was really giving an image of like he's had some kind of spiritual conversion and he's like a right wing Christian radio guy now. I don't know what they dress like, but I just bought it.
This tuxedo top really does work. But with my skinny tie.
No tie that I could find. Silver's for the podcast listeners, as you guys don't own ties, those are useful. Not a tie that I could find without maybe 5 to 7 minutes of searching my entire apartment. I don't have like one handy, you know. There's like one part out. Ben probably has a few more, but that would just be
I believe I own two ties
to weddings. You wear a tie to a wedding, or do you go
I mean, I know I have at least one because I wore it to Griscom's wedding a few weeks ago.
Okay, right? Yeah, so I was curious. Yeah,
but I don't. I think I still own another. I think there's another that did make it through all the moves to LA, but I actually have no idea where that one is. So there's like one tie for sure. But I was thinking about going to find it when I saw Andy just to like join the bit. But I was like, now this feels more natural. Let's just do this.
Yeah. So by the way, the Q&A is not April Fool's. So please give us your questions. We have some stuff planned in the meantime while we collect some, but now is the time to ask Ben Burgess everything you wanted to know.
Yeah. No, we will take questions within, you know, reason about anything. It's funny that Mercutio, it's funny that you mentioned Jason, because I've been telling him for years that if he ever wanted to pretend that he's become a conservative, like, look, don't get me wrong, I would be the number in my bank account would get pretty hilariously different, right? I mean, I would definitely have a dramatically much more comfortable life, you know, the kind of, I wouldn't have to buy health insurance off the exchange, but if I did, the kind I'd be able to get would be much better. But like Jason, like as the like, extremely funny and charismatic black guy is like with a history as like a political left-wing political commentator, maybe not for 2024, but by 2028, if Jason did the transition, by 2028 he would for sure have a speaking slot at the RNC. Like I think he'd have that.
Well, they could find you in conservative form already, like, yeah, exactly. At least 5 or 6 of you, right? Like
there are former
leftists. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who look like you.
I don't think I'm bringing anything to the table that would be that special. I mean, like I said, I definitely have a much better life, but like,
Money. They'd give you just like money lying around and like in between their cushions and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. I would get the money stuck behind the couch cushions, which is to say that like, you know, you could add you could move the decimal point a couple times of my like current like annual income, like immediately. Right. But like, but yeah, the Jason they would be excited about. Be like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I should come in. No, we've got some. Jeeves, do you have the couch cushion money that you were collecting earlier? Yeah, give that to Ben. he decided he hates poor people now. So we could definitely, you know, there'd be some fellowships. I wouldn't have to worry about health insurance, but like. But yeah, that would be an entirely different story for Jason.
Yeah, I had a bet that Jason was going to really appreciate that. I was going to mention that Michael Sweet from Striper was going to do our new theme song. And that was only for Jason, that joke. Because I don't think anybody else finds that funny.
Well, you could do a one person joke on a podcast and a live audience. That is tough because you could hear the silence. But podcast, you know,
I don't know. There's probably like one person in the chat who knows what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, everyone just assumes it's an inside joke, but only they don't get it. So
yeah. The rest of us are laughing. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a few of that have come in, but do we want to check out a little bit of what our would-be partners, what they're up to.
Yes, by all means. I was thinking about trying to slide in. Like I said, I was trying to hit like 40% believable. So like there'd be some people who'd be bothered by it. Like, okay, I think this is a joke, but I'm starting to worry. Right. But like, so I didn't throw this in, but I was thinking of incorporating that, you know, that we were actually going to be taking Candace's slot. So the time worked out really well.
Yeah. Well, I was like, I think I was kind of selling it, but the problem is I was being way more professional than I just normally am on the show. So I guess was part of the bit, but it's kind of like, you know, like you're trying too hard.
No, that's fair. So when we do start taking questions, I see we've got Silver at 517. So let's make sure we go back all the way to there and start with that. I think that's the first question. But yeah, before that, let's check in on our future business partners.
Oh yeah, this is the slot that this is the drama that led to the slot.
The slot opening up, exactly.
Okay.
One of the consequences of this war has been a lot of very high passions on both sides, a lot of angry disagreements. You and your company have been at the center of a very high-profile one at the moment with Candace Owens, who's now left Daily Wire. Was she fired, or did she leave of her own volition?
I'm not going to speak to this topic, Pierce.
At all?
At all.
You can't give me any insight into why she departed?
Another thing that would have ruined the bit, but I was very close to just starting to talk really nasal and really fast when I was talking about our involvement with the Daily Wire, because it's very easy to sound like Ben Shapiro, but he always sounds like a parody of himself.
No hints. I'm not going to speak to this.
Can I ask why?
I mean, you can ask.
No, I'll ask why you don't want to say anything.
Again, you can ask.
I'm only curious because I know what a staunch defender of free speech you are.
Ooh.
It would surprise me if it had been someone's opinions that would make you want to part company with them. However,
the only thing I will say is what I've said all along with regard to Candace or with regard to any of our other hosts. I am not in hiring and firing position with the Daily Wire. I'm a co-founder of the Daily Wire. I'm a co-owner of the Daily Wire. I'm not.
Okay. One thing I was going to say just real quick is that, you know, Piers Morgan is, you know, I'm trying to come up with some polite synonyms here, but like, you know, whatever, he is what he is. But like, despite that, this is so fucking British. It's like, I'll ask because I would be very surprised, you know, given your well-known commitment to free speech.
He fucking Hugh Grant, that Hugh Grant ass, like, you know, just kind of like floated up there. I was talking with Andy before the show that, you know, when it comes to Piers, like, it's just like, I think there's some real demons probably in the British journalistic class that I'm not even very aware of, but some of their people compared to our people at the same level, they just seem to have like an ounce more of like, at least I'm going to challenge you a little bit, if we're on the same side. Like I'm also, maybe it's only when it comes to Ben Shapiro, who is the guy, the conservative guy that Ben just got wrecked by the British.
Andrew Neil.
Yeah. Andrew Neil. We're like, you know, just because like we're both conservatives doesn't mean that, I don't know if that's what Piers would describe himself, but anyway, it doesn't mean I'm just going to give you these like softball questions all the time. You know what I mean? So like, I was caught off guard before.
I mean, Piers is just kind of a not that impressive centrist as far as I can tell, but like but But Andrew Neil is like a real like right wing Tory, right? I mean, like it's just that he works for the BBC and British journalism conventions are enough different that like you're expected to ask people hard questions, like, squirm a little bit, you know, just to like show that you're serious.
Just for fun.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well, I do want to keep going here.
Not actually in management. Jeremy Boring and Caleb Robinson are in management.
I'm sure they don't listen to him.
To Candace or anyone else. And as far as the free speech situation, what I will say is that no company has the obligation to literally pay anyone. The Daily Wire is a publisher. It is not a platform. I've never called for Candace or anyone else for that matter to be banned from YouTube, to be banned from X, to be banned from any platform. That's a different story, obviously, when it comes to any publisher. Any publisher gets to make decisions about what it wishes to purvey and not.
I mean, I'm not going to labor this, but one more point I would make is it's been reported extensively that the reason for her departure was because her comments have been perceived by people at the Daily Wire as anti-Semitic.
Again, I'm not going to comment on this, Piers.
Okay. Rabbi Shmuley, you comment on him because Jeremy has actually commented on.
Okay. I will say the next part about Rabbi Shmuley is quite interesting.
Okay. Well, we can do Rabbi Shmuley in a minute. I've thought about that, by the way, that I do see that the good rabbi has open DMs on Twitter. And I'm like, you know, he seems crazy enough that I could actually imagine him taking invitations from random podcasts. And I thought about it. It's like, but I don't actually know that I want that.
Will he show up wearing that costume that he wore?
Andy, me and my therapist made a solemn vow that I would never think or acknowledge the existence of Shmuley's foreign costume.
But you know what's even crazier? Do you know that his daughter runs a sex? I do.
There's a lot of
kosher sex toys.
Yes.
Well, I think when I heard that, I know that from you. I think that I was like, okay, I just thought he was one of these, you know, guys that just kind of came from the same eco sphere as these other right wing Zionist figures. And I'm like, oh, this is a certified weirdo. And no offense to anyone who has a daughter who owns a dildo shop, but I just think this guy's in a different playing field than some of these other people.
No, look,
he's a goofy weirdo. Yeah.
I know half of our listeners have daughters with dildo shops. You know, we definitely don't want to alienate that huge demographic, but yeah, look, I think that the daughter with the dildo shop isn't even the main thing. It's that he's like promoted the daughter's dildo shops. Like, no, this is, you're right. I mean, this is not just like your run of the mill, like, right wing Zionist creep that like you could find 1,000 of. Like, this is a special creature. There's only one of him, and so that's why I'm like almost fascinated enough to send the invitation. But then it's like, I don't know, man. It's like, especially if I'm like, if we're not on like another platform, I'm just the host, that it's like, well, I mean, he's just gonna like yell stupid shit, and I don't know that that's gonna serve any like purpose or be interesting or educational for anybody, but
it's about how the sex toy is slaughtered, Jim.
Now I'm just imagining like a cartoon, like sentient sex toy, you know, like hanging upside down, you know, the like kosher slaughterhouse style.
I'm gonna have a lot to talk about with my therapist.
You don't want to mix dairy with your meats.
They don't. I'm not going to go down the road of riffing on the dairy and meat jokes that can be made here. Good taste is going to prevail. We're going to skip right past that. Also an interesting question here, right, about the why it matters, right? Because kosher usually only matters for things you're going to eat. But anyway,
yeah,
that's, yeah, yeah, you yeah. know, it's It's good question. It's like there's a classic story about this great rabbinical authority, the Maharal, is being asked. This woman comes in and she's so concerned, you know, as that she has a pet cat, and wait a second, but like her cat's kosher. And because he doesn't want to embarrass her, he takes the biggest, heaviest book off the shelf and makes a big show of doing this. It's like, it is not kosher, but you can still keep it in your house. Okay. So, and by the way, I love the smile we paused on here. This worked out really well, but it's just smirky fuck. But anyway,
his whole body language changed as soon as Candace Owens is brought up. It's just hilarious, just kind of watching him just tense up. If at some point, Jake, you should play it back in slow motion.
Yeah. So I think that there are a couple things to say. One of them is the one Jake already said, which is that it's fucking hilarious that he's acted as if he doesn't have any say over who gets fired at the Daily Wire. He's like, yeah, I co-founded the company and I still own half of it, but I'm not making my day-to-day management decisions. Like, I'm sure if I expressed an opinion about what I wanted to happen, nobody would listen to that.
Imagine if GTAA expanded and then Jason became the CEO and it was to give them an argument network. And then, I get fired for, I don't know.
And I'm like, hey, I don't, Jason's making the hire and fire decisions. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Just be so.
Jake who?
We can let people in the comments think about what take I would actually have that would cause Ben to. I was gonna say Led Zeppelin, but I love Led Zeppelin, so I have no. It's got to be something else. Jason says you all don't want that, but yeah. So that's what I'm saying. That was.
No,
but that was bullshit point number one, and there was something else.
Was bullshit point number one.
Yeah,
but then number two is the thing. I'm going to do the credit where credit's due here thing and quote somebody who I agree with about almost nothing, as is I think very clear from the times we've played him on the show in the past. But I actually saw Sagar and Jetty, of all people, making this point earlier today, where he was like, look, you can take this line. We're a publisher. We're under no obligation. There's no free speech thing. That is a position you can consistently take about this, but then don't fucking complain if there's a controversy in the New York Times about publishing the Tom Cotton op-ed or something like that. It's what, they're a publisher, right? What's the difference? And I can even understand, they're, publishers that have points of view and, they're going to tend to have stuff that reflect it. But also, when you have people who are generally within, the camp of who you would have. And by the way, let's not pretend it's anti-Semitism is the issue that the. And I'm not saying that to say Candace Owens is not an anti-Semite. Candace Owens probably is an anti-Semite. But I don't think that's why she got fired, right? I don't think she got more anti-Semitic in the last 6 months, right? I mean, all of her classic comments about how if all Hitler had wanted to do was make Germany great again, that would have been fine and all that stuff, right? That all predates that. That they didn't have an issue with, right? So it's not the anti-Semitism; it's the criticism of Israel, which I understand they wouldn't make a distinction between the two. But that's why she got fired. But when you have people who are generally within your camp and they disagree with you about some things, and then the question is whether to keep them on or fire them. I would say, look, is it a free speech issue exactly? No, not really. And you could say that the Tom Cotton thing wasn't either, right? But but is there a free speech adjacent issue there? I think there kind of is, right? That there's that the question is how open are you to exposing your audience to a little bit of tension between, opposing points of views and, letting them letting them figure stuff out for themselves, right? Do you guys remember Ben Glebe? Do you know who that is?
Rings a bell.
Okay, so he's a comedian and like a pundit, and he goes on like the, I don't know if he, I think he might just be like a guest host, but anyway, I've definitely seen him on the Young Turks a bunch, right? And he was the one who did the debate with Charlie Kirk the week before I did, the dolphin fetus guy, right? And he's like god awful at Israel Palestine, right? He's really, really bad on it. And I don't know. I mean, like, I've seen him and Cenk like yell at each other about it on air, and they still keep on having him back on air, right? And it's like, I don't know. Kind of makes me think a little bit more highly of those people and a little bit less highly of the Daily Wire, that they're like a little bit more thick skinned about having people who are going to say things they don't like be on their, you know, whatever the internet version is of airwaves, and, you know, and go back and forth with it about it. Like, I hate everything he says about it, but it's like, honestly, I think it's like, yeah, if you're confident in your position, I mean, fuck it. Let Ben Glebe come on and say his stupid bullshit.
Yeah. I think, I'm okay with them letting somebody loose if they want to argue that some viewpoint they expressed is so against the core value of the channel, but that's just not the argument that he's making. Instead, the argument he's making is the one that you already said. And the only thing I wanted to add is just that, you know, I'm not the first to say this, but there's free speech as like a legal question and also free speech as just a general value. And people conflate the two to try to sidestep the second thing, which is like, do you generally believe in like a very, you know, in a marketplace, to use a Daily Wire metaphor they probably like, but a marketplace of ideas, like, do you genuinely believe in that? You know, and I think that value is very different. You know, having that value system is different than like, do you legally believe in like, you know, the right to have like free speech? Yeah. They're different things. Exactly. And he's just going, you know, he's doing this knee-jerk BS response based on the first. If he wants to argue that, you know, supporting Israel is just like a core value proposition on that network, just in the same way that maybe if we have the GTA network and then Jay Andy's show, he starts, you know, talking about the free market every day, maybe we'd have a talk with him. I don't know. But I feel like at the end of the day, we'd have to make that case to our subscribers of like why the show is let go. I don't think that everyone is mandated to, you know, to keep everyone that they hire on infinitely on their show necessarily, you know, on their network, but
no,
he's not even making the case. So that's the problem that I
think that's a weird argument that you make, because tomorrow I'm actually covering Wall Street on Movie Night Extravaganza.
No, don't worry, Andy.
Yeah. No, if you start to notice a very different art style on the show in the near future, this is why. No. I mean, look, I do generally believe, and I wouldn't use the phrase free market, open marketplace of ideas, because I don't love that metaphor, but
I would
say the open lib coffee shop of ideas, right? That's the
anarchist coffee shop. Anarchist co-op coffee shop.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, the more I describe this, the more annoying it sounds, the less I like this metaphor either. But anyway, can you imagine the people? This would be like an Infinite Portlandia episode.
The
anarchist cooperative coffee shop of ideas. But anyway, like, look, I have a, you know, but it's like, yeah, I'm generally in favor of providing a chair for everybody to come to the coffee shop and express their ideas. But yeah, and I also like, I saw Skellum from chat saying, you know, that like, if you really take the sort of legal, really hard line on what's a free speech issue, even big tech censorship would be fine. Right. And it's like, look, I think it's legitimate to say there's a difference. This is like the part of, you know, other Ben's argument here that I know isn't totally crazy, right? It's like legitimate to say there's some difference between like a platform and a publisher, but like, you know, I think that even so, right, it's like, I do think what you said earlier, right, that there's like a difference between the legal issue or even the sort of like protections that you might hope for on an open platform and a sort of general value of hashing shit out and, you know, letting people have their say, and that he is like collapsing a lot of that to avoid just like forthrightly saying like, yep, nope, sorry, nobody could disagree with me about this. Which, you know, which, look, if I ever had to fire you for shitting on Led Zeppelin on the show, I would just say it, right? it's like, yeah, no, sorry. I have a, you know, he said that, you know, I don't know what would be the take that the, that, you know, he said that it was like a
second rate Kiss cover band. I can't even think of it.
Yeah, no, I would actually quote that every subsequent Monday to like remind people why you weren't here anymore. But, I mean, it's just the whole thing's incredibly disingenuous. And I also think that, to again call balls and strikes here, I actually think Owens herself had like a pretty funny response I saw on Twitter earlier, which was, "Hey Ben, we agreed not to talk about it. I see you keep going on shows and talking about it while pretending not to talk about it. Would you like me to do the same?" Right? Like, which is like, yeah, that does kind of feel like that, right? Because it's like, if you're really not going to talk about it, don't talk about it. But like, a lot of this stuff is like definitely not talking about it, talking about it.
Yeah, that's Ben's little game, but
let's do some questions. I think we have several of them at this point.
All right, from Silver, for the Q&A, do you remember a couple of years ago you were contributing to a book? I think it was called The Plan. How's that going? That's my question. I told you it wasn't about S5 modal logic.
Yeah, no. Infamously, when I used to have the show in Colin, Silver, I think actually did. I did one that was like I was totally open. He actually had this like hyper technical question about S5 modal logic. So the book is called The Blueprint, so it's from Verso. It's co-written by me and Mike Beggs and Bhaskar Sankara. I think the full title might be something like The Blueprint: Life After Capitalism. Quite a bit of it's been written. We actually were recently talking in our emails back and forth about it. I don't know. Did either of you guys ever watch an old sketch comedy show called The Human Giant?
I did. Yeah. It had Kamel, right? Or no, it didn't.
Fuck. No, that one didn't. But yeah, they have
I know what you're talking about. Pretend I didn't say that. I know what you're talking about.
There's a clip that I actually sent an email recently that where there's these guys who are talking about where to go to lunch the next day, and they're like, okay, we need to really commit to it. Let's take a blood oath. And they actually do, like, you know, they work together at like a Best Buy or something, and they go into like the storeroom and there's like music and they have like candles lit up and they're like slashing open their hands to do the blood oath. So I had, and then the gag is they decide the next day they actually feel like something else. But but anyway, I sat that clip. I was like, okay, can we do a blood oath to actually have a complete draft by the end of the summer? And everybody said yes. So I'm cautiously optimistic we'll have a complete draft by the end of the summer. We actually did do a public event last summer. Like it was like Labor Day weekend, I think, in Chicago, where we gave like a little preview of it. We did one that was all together, and then also Mike did like a solo one at the Socialism Conference in Chicago. So it is coming along. If you want a preview of it, Mike wrote a really good article for Catalyst called something like "Markets in the Workplace Under a Democratic Socialism." And it was then reprinted in Jacobin. I do not remember what the Jacobin title is, but if you just search Jacobin Mike Beggs, Beggs, you'll find it pretty easily. And that gives you a pretty good preview of what we're going to say in the book.
Okay, nice. We have another question. It was about, okay, well, let me go to the one that I see right here. Question: if you could bring one person on GTA for an interview via time machine, who would you pick?
G.A. Cohen. I know that's like very boringly predictable because he's a figure I reference all the time, but also one, I think he was just an absurdly smart person and like also very, very, very clear in how he'd explain complicated ideas all the time. And, you know, he had a lot of interesting things to say. The other thing too, is that for an analytic philosopher, he was shockingly funny. Like, there are these home videos that, so I think they're from like a party. They're in like John Romer's living room that have made their way to YouTube of Cohen, just like doing impressions of different historical figures. And I remember actually playing one of those for Michael Brooks. And he was like, okay, I wish you hadn't played this for me, 'cause this makes me mad that he's dead, 'cause now I want him on my show.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was actually Cohen.
What's that?
That was my introduction to Cohen.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. That's a good answer. We have another one. Question. Is there anyone on the right who actually engages in good faith debates other than Sohrab, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I do think Sohrab comes to mind. I have always gotten the sense from him that, you know, because we've done two of them at this point, right? So there was the original one, which was basically on like social issues, right? The sort of me making my best case for this kind of baseline social liberalism that, you know, everybody should be able to do what they want, basically, you know, within that doesn't hurt anybody else, basically. And that was like interesting, but I think it was also sort of over such a huge conceptual gulf that like, I don't really feel like I said anything that, you know, it's a certain point, like what is there to say, right? You know, cause the premises are just so different. But then when his book Tyranny Inc. came out and he came back on the show, we did one that was really just specifically about socialism, right? That was like, cause like everybody else who I saw who was like a leftist who interviewed him about that book, I saw was basically doing some version of basically the first debate. Like, yeah, you have a lot of great things to say about economics, but now what about these like, you know, bad positions you have on social issues? And both because everybody else was doing that and because I'd kind of already done that with him, I wanted to do this like, no. Let's actually talk about the economics part, because I think there's also an interesting disagreement there, right? Because because ultimately he does stop short of, you know, being a socialist. And I think that, you know, and I'm not saying this is a bad faith thing, but I mean, I think that it's true that his positioning on the right would be impossible if he ever did make that transition, right? Because it's like, you can get a certain number of right aligned people to nod along with, okay, corporations have too much power, et cetera. But then would you say, therefore, we actually should not any longer have, you know, like capitalist markets and people can buy and sell the means of production. We should have democracy at work. Then, you know, you're going to lose those people, right? And I actually think that one was a little bit more interesting because the premises are closer. So it was like good to see, you know. So like I think he had to sweat a little bit more, you know, meeting the challenge, and he committed himself to some things I was really surprised by, right? Because I mean, there was literally a point in that debate where I was like, okay, but like wouldn't a lot of your arguments here apply to, you know, I mean, like, look, you agree it's better that we have republics than monarchies, right? Right. And I think he's like, well, you know, should to like, you know, that like, it's, even if it was like a limited constitutional monarchy, it's still bad for somebody to be able to inherit all this power. Right. Because once you concede that, you have to be like, well, why is it okay if it's economic power? Right. You know, because that people can inherit, you know, dad's company the same way you can inherit dad's throne. And so, yeah, I thought that was interesting. But I will say, right, every time I've had one of these, like, he always seems to, like, you can always tell, I mean, I don't know, like, I always get a very strong impression that he's, like, really taking his time to, like, take in whatever argument you're making and, like, think about it and think about how he's going to respond to it, which is nice because, look, this is not always true. Right. For people that I argue with on the show, to put it mildly. Right. I mentioned there was a Brianna Wu follow-up, right? This is, so I don't know if we should do it now, or I don't know, maybe we should take a couple more questions first, but I guess to more directly address Shiggity Shank's question, because I just talked about Sohrab. Yeah, I think that some libertarians do. I think libertarians tend to be more likely than conservatives to be like kind of really sort of nerdily engaged in ideas for their own sake, and you know, to sort of go at it in a way that's more interest in there. I think some of the debates I've had with libertarians felt like that to me. Like I felt like a lot of what they think is like completely goofy, but I think they're not only sincere about it, which is also true of some of the conservatives, of course, you know, most of the conservatives, right? But like also that they're willing to like really think about and engage with arguments against what they think in ways that like a lot of conservatives are less likely to, because they're just so iced into the worldview that they have trouble taking basic challenges to it seriously.
All right. I think we're ready for the next question. Ben, read your two recent articles. Are land back left thinking of an Aristotelian negation of the negation, simply a reversal of power versus a dialectical negation of the negation? No one should have.
Okay.
Let me leave it up.
I can see that somebody saying this out of context might not really be sure what's going on here, but I think I actually do. So Secret Agent Dan, I think, is actually making a really interesting point here. So
yes. I'm laughing just because it just seems really advanced.
No, there's like a lot of stuff going on here, but I think we can make it simple relatively quickly, right? So I assume the two recent articles he's talking about are the last two essays on my Substack. So the one that went up yesterday is called Formal and Dialectical Logic, and it's actually like the transcript essentially of a talk I gave while I was in Michigan the week before for Matt McManus's Hegel Reading Group in Ann Arbor. They asked me to come talk about formal and dialectical logic. And so formal logic, right? Like what you learn if you take a logic class in college is the stuff with like the letters and symbols and all that stuff, right? That's formal logic. So the negation of a statement is just like that statement is not true. So double negation just takes you back to the original statement, right? If you're negating the negation of a statement, you're just asserting the original statement. And in the formal and dialectical logic talk, I made the point that Frederick Engels in his book, The Anti-During, which by the way, always got a pause to feel bad for During, that it's been surely at least 100 years since anybody thought about his name in any context other than Engels having written a book called The Anti-During. But in that, you know, when he's talking about these principles of dialectical thinking, one of them is the negation of the negation. And I made the point that what he's talking about here isn't really like negation in the sense that formal logic sense of negation. And in fact, a good example of what he's talking about is the part in Capital, which, by the way, this is a good time to tease. I'm going to be teaching a Capital class. I did that before for a long time, but it's been a long time since it ended. I'm going to teach a new one started sometime in the next few weeks. We'll get some artwork and announce it and all that good stuff soon. It's going to be on Sundays, like early afternoon EST for anybody who wants to come do that. But just to spoil the book, the last section of Capital is about the enclosures where, you know, peasants are driven off their land at the birth of capitalism. And Marx basically says at the conclusion of that section, you know, so it's like the end of chapter 32. So there's one more chapter after that, but it's like the conclusion of that whole argument. He says, look, there's no turning back the clock. You can't, there's no restoring like what the property relations were before the enclosures happened, but you could expropriate the expropriators. That in other words, you can all this, you know, land that was taken over by capitalists who drove off the peasants, that he says, actually, it's going to be much easier to expropriate the expropriators, that he says this can happen much more quickly and peacefully than the original expropriation, because instead of the vast majority of the population being expropriated by a few people, it's a few people being expropriated by the vast majority. And you're not going to go back to what you had before, of course, impossible and not desirable and whatever, but you can go forward to something better, right? So in that case, the negation of the negation, unlike that strict logical sense, doesn't bring you back to where you started. It takes you forward to something new. And the way all this relates to the land back thing is that I think that sometimes when people are thinking about when people are thinking about Israel-Palestine and the right of return and all of that stuff, which, by the way, I had an article about the right of return that came out yesterday. I think we have the graphic for that.
Are you able to put it up? Because I'm holding the place for the questions. No,
I can do that. Let me find it. Yep, here we go. Right. So this is the it's called Palestinians' Right of Return is a Basic Question of Justice. And the article is devoted to arguing that, you know, you don't have to assume anything larger about, you know, bigger sort of clashing nationalist narratives or anything to support a right of return, that this just follows from sort of super basic universal human rights stuff. So I'm actually going to be going, by the way, on, if anybody listens to Sirius in their car when they, drive to work, Thursday, this coming Thursday at, 8:45 in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. So 5:45 AM for me. So I don't know how coherent I'm going to be, but I'm going to try. I'm going on the POTUS channel, the Politics of the United States channel in Sirius XM, to talk to Laura Coates about that article. So I don't know if it's going to be a friendly interview or not, but we will see. But in any case, I'm like very strongly in favor of right of return for Palestinian refugees as part of just, you know, again, just universal human rights protections for everybody. But then some people say, well, what about the land issues, right? What about like land that was stolen in 1948? And, you know, what are you going to do there? Don't you have to have a sort of backward looking like rectification of past injustices? And, you know, and the way this relates to it is basically that I think that, look, it's not, I don't think that trying to restore the property divisions of an undeveloped country in the 1940s is a particularly viable prospect. I don't even think that, like, if you go back to before, I mean, really the early process of like Zionists taking Palestinian land was sort of quasi-legal. You'd find absentee landowners with dubious claims and buy it from them and expel the people who live there and all that. So if you're really going to reverse all that, you're going back to like the late Ottoman Empire kind of property divisions, which I don't necessarily think was the time that justice was achieved either. So what I would say is, look, I don't want land back. I want land nationalized to so it can be used to equally benefit everybody, regardless of, you know, race, creed, or color. And you know, this is very closely parallel to arguments that, you know, happen in the US context when people are thinking about like racial justice, that the end of Jim Crow still left all of these like huge disparities, between different racial demographics, you know, which is true, right? I mean, I would say it's impossible to deny it, but you know, there are all these people who do, right? You know, this is, who say that it's like, oh, it's not really because of Jim Crow. It's because of like, I don't know, laziness or, you know, people not pulling their pants up or whatever. Right. But, putting aside those people, right, I think it's like pretty undeniable what the historical connection is there. But then the question is, well, what's your goal, right? Is your goal to have the correct proportion of every racial group living at every step of the economic hierarchy, the right proportions living in poverty? You have, you know, 12%, you know, black shareholders at, you know, at Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and, you know, all that stuff. Or is the goal to create a more equal society for everybody, right? Is the problem that's like too many of the wrong group are at the bottom, or that nobody should be in those conditions? So yeah, I hope that answers all of that, but, that would be my perspective on that. And I know there's a lot going on in the question, but I hope I hit all of that.
Nice. Okay, quick one, but did you see Dawkins come out as a cultural Christian? Always feel like it was only a matter of time. I definitely got a kick out of that. I know that you probably have tracked Dawkins much longer and more seriously than I have.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd say that exactly, but
yes, maybe not seriously. But yeah.
I did see that, and I did, you know, chuckle. it's like, come on, man. What is that? But
I guess he celebrates Christmas, but doesn't go to church on Sundays.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if that's what it takes, then he's just like a normal British Christian, it sounds like. But anyway, I thought it was pretty fucking silly. I think it's deeply unimpressive, might be one way to put that. But I also think it makes some sense. Because there was a time when, my kind of grand unified theory of new atheism is that, it was something that basically only could have existed at the, really specific cultural moment that it existed in. Which is not to say that, there won't always be people who are interested in religion and atheism and arguing about whether there's a God. Of course there will, right? That's just a subject of enduring human interest. But the idea that there was, a movement about it, and this was this thing that had this huge amount of cultural purchase, I think could have only happened exactly when it happened, right? That this is something that that I think basically happened for two related reasons, right? One of them is that if you think about sort of reactions to 9/11 and paranoia about Muslim terrorism in American culture, I think basically there was a conservative version of it and a lib version of it. The conservative version of it was the George W. Bush version, right? That it's not that Bush said this. He was, certainly smarter than to say stuff like this, but as not smart, but smarter than that, right? But the version a lot of people who are really into Bush were, which was Islam is bad, but Christianity is good. Right. So we need to fight the Muslim hordes and, the name of Christianity. That was the conservative, that was the red state version. But then the blue state version was, maybe it's just religion in general is bad. Right. And so I think, which in a way is a less, bigoted version of it. Although also Hitchens and Harris were certainly supported a lot of the crazy Bush shit anyway. Dawkins didn't, to be fair to him. I'm sure Dawkins probably supported Afghanistan, but at least not Iraq. And Dennett, I don't know if anybody asked him, but anyway,
I've been waiting for somebody to ask me. I have such a good take on this, but no one's asked me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's just a philosopher. He's a nerd. But that's half of it. Then the other half of it is, and I think the main thing really, right, is because people forget how much new atheism was a phenomenon of blue America, right? And it was a huge thing at the time. Christopher Hitchens was constantly having Fox News invite him on to yell at him about God.
Recent rally?
Yes, I do.
I was there.
Oh, no shit. there was an episode of Family Guy where Brian meets one of his girlfriends because they're at Barnes & Noble, and they're both reaching for Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, at the same time. It was all over the place, right? But I think a lot of that is because the culture war was so different then. That this is a time when, I think the basic lib anxiety about the right wasn't really that, they're racist and fascist like it would be now, right? I mean, there was some of that, but not really, right? I think it was really that they're, scary Jesus-y people who want to ban abortion and teach creationism in schools and, put gay people back in the closet. Right. That was the anxiety. And I think new atheism, that kind of branding, that movie spoke to that. Right. So I think that, whereas now the culture war has just changed dramatically. Like evangelicals might still be Trump's most reliable and the GOP's most reliable, you know, voting bloc. They are, right? White evangelicals are. But the culture war has shifted so much that it's like nobody really cares that Trump doesn't bother to pretend to be one of them, right? It's like I like the sort of the joke I always make about this is that Trump could give a speech in front of an inverted cross in a pool of blood, and as long as he owned the libs in the speech, like the evangelicals would be fine with it. They'd be like, ah, yeah, well, we don't totally agree with him about that, you know, Satan thing, but still, right? Like, still good stuff. So yeah, I think that because the culture war has shifted so dramatically, it no longer makes sense in the same way for like atheism to be somebody's main thing, right? That they have it's like, oh, what, we're all going to be best friends now because like we don't think there's a God.
I mean, the only thing is that, you know, if you have a group trying to overturn those state laws where they're still are on the books saying that you can't serve in public office if you're an atheist, like that's the only real thing I could see an atheist movement do. I don't see any. I mean, those laws should be overturned, whether you're an atheist or not.
No, of course they should be, right? Like, there's a lot of other separation of church and state kind of stuff that, like, atheist groups might talk about that I'm all for talking about. But, like, but you know, I think when everybody's a little bit less focused on that issue, you start to notice that, oh, hey, all of us who might be here at the Reason Rally together don't actually agree on, like, most things that matter the most, right? So, which is why, I mean, certainly anecdotally, right? It's like, you know, people are all over the place, right? A certain percentage of like grassroots new atheists became like IDW people and like got themselves to the point where they like love Jordan Peterson, although he's like always spouting mystical horse shit. And, but there's also like a big proportion of grassroots new atheists, anecdotally at least. I don't know that anybody's done a poll on this. But people who were like super duper into that, who I knew, you know, back then, or I know now, and they've talked to me about it then, who are like, you know, Jacobin-y kinds of leftists now, right? I mean, people go in all sorts of different directions. So it's like, yeah, I think Dawkins was always a bit of an Islamophobe. You know, he always made some unsavory comments about that from time to time. He's also, you know, I think that like some of his cultural preoccupations now, I think he's like probably more aligned with like a lot of people who like hearing him say he's a cultural Christian. And I know it's not, somebody pointed out in the chat, it's not the first time he said it, but you know, this is the time that got the most play, right? So it's like, as funny as it is, it doesn't totally shock me that he's trying to square that circle a little bit now, or in the last several years, maybe in general. The only other, and yeah, I don't know. I guess my other thing about Richard Dawkins is that he's just, I think he's kind of the ultimate dumb smart guy. That, in other words, like he's clearly like a very good biologist. And he's actually a very, very good like popularizer of biology. Like when he's just writing to like explain evolutionary biology to laymen, he's actually really good at it. But like every time he steps out of that and starts talking about other subjects, it gets really weird, right? Like, remember that thing where he was like, oh, you know, I don't understand why Kafka's The Metamorphosis is considered to be such a classic. It doesn't even make sense. You know, you can't turn into a cockroach. What is that? You know, like, it's, you know, this, like, I'm strawmanning what he said, but only a little bit. It was like really close to that. So it's like, yeah, I think like when he's not talking about science, he says a bunch of stupid bullshit, and so I just don't pay that much attention.
All right, this one's for me. I'll answer quickly. Question, Jake, what model of record player do you have behind you? If you're in the market for a new one, what record player would you get? I want to say I am not an expert on this stuff. My girlfriend very nicely picked it out for me for Christmas. We're both cultural. Neither of us are Christian, but you know, Christmas is fun. I have a RT82 from Fluence.
Cultural Judeo-Christian.
Yes, exactly. The one thing I'm going to say, if you're looking into this stuff, the speaker that you get with the record player is like probably just as important. I don't have a great one. I have an Edifier I think R1280. And you also have to get something called a preamp, which like actually amplifies the sound from the record player. I knew nothing about this before it was purchased for me. I will say it is a fun, hobby that I've continued to do. The poster that I have behind me actually came from Stereolab Emperor Tomato Ketchup vinyl, came with a free poster. So there's fun stuff that comes from actually getting physical media. And honestly, a lot of the records do sound are either like they're individually remastered for vinyl, so you actually do hear unique stuff, or they actually do sound, they definitely sound better than like the shittily compressed Spotify versions. You could probably change your Spotify settings to, I think, to actually get a really high quality digital sound. But I'll just say I hear the difference. It's not bullshit to me. Some people would probably say, I mean, CDs, I think, are technically the best audio you could get these days would be to just buy a CD. Andy's making faces.
So there's a technical thing. Like, yes, CDs are technically the best.
Like, however, you get the most information.
There's a warmth to vinyl that you do not have in other mediums. And that is why it has lasted. I also still find it ridiculous that it is 2024 and they still don't make preamps and record players. Like, you know, I remember the 90s working at Radio Shack having to, you know, make sure people buy their preamps whenever they buy a turntable.
Andy knows actually a lot more than this. I will be the avatar for a complete neophyte who is enjoying the hobby, but Ben did.
I definitely know the least of anybody on screen right now. I did have a vinyl record player with the speakers, with the wires and all that stuff in like a long time ago, but I've just moved too many times. I actually literally don't even know where or in what state that is now. But actually, this would be a really good time to take it up again because I live in an area that's very dense with vinyl record shops. This is, you know, I mean, this is kind of as much as I make fun of a lot of the hipsterishness of some parts of the, you know, where I live in Northeast LA, that would actually be really useful. So, you know, but I don't know anything fucking whatsoever about the, you know, quality of, you know, the information or whatever, but I do have that feeling that it sounds warmer, right? Like that is definitely a thought of, you know, like, you know, that is my sense. And I actually, it's a kind of, that's interesting. This conversation might actually inspire me to get one again.
Good. Because the nice thing is that when they get a little fucked up, if they start nice, there's a benefit, you know, the crackles and all that stuff actually, versus a CD, you know, just gets scratched and skips and stuff like that. What were you saying, Andy?
Did you see that somebody took a bunch of copies of, I forget which Beatles album. I want to say the White Album. And would start it, like they take all the copies, they start at the same moment, and you can actually hear as the record plays how like each version starts to distort because of time of use and play. Because like that's the other thing too, is like each record is your record. Like it is very specifically worn differently and plays differently because of the amount of times it's been played, the warmth, wornness of it, if it's gotten warped by heat, any of that kind of stuff. You know, affects the sound. And it's one of those interesting things, like, you know, like each record is unique. So like it is a kind of a one of a kind listening experience in a way.
And look, I'm, I think 32, I'm turning 33 soon. For any of the younger folks, listen, you're going to have to start getting pretty dry, boring hobbies when you, you know, like to sustain yourself into your 30s and 40s and beyond, and find yourself just like listening to like one of the most like milquetoast Midwestern guys just, you know, wax poetically, no pun intended, about which pressing of Rumors, you know, like literally go through all 30 pressings or whatever, the Japanese pressing and go, you know, so I haven't watched one of those in a bit, but I'm just saying, this is a good one. if you're looking for. I'm just saying it is good.
I will also say. I guess two more things about this. One is, I am just generally a big fan of physical media, and like I've actually, I mean, I don't have very many because I see above removing too much. I actually ended up having to leave like a lot of these in Georgia, just because of space, right? But in, but you know, I've been trying to like buy DVDs again, like I love for a variety of reasons. Right. Like I like having like actual physical copies of things. And the other is that I do see Mr. Miles in the chat expressing two music related opinions, one of which I'm open to, the other of which I'll fight him on. So one is that he's been defending, you know, CDs in this conversation. It's like, you know what? I'm open to that. I'll hear that out. The second one, though, is he said something earlier about like not bothering with any of the Zeppelin.
Yeah, no Houses of the Holy
after four, and it's like, come on, man. I'm not even that. I mean, whatever. Obviously, Houses of the Holy is very good, but like, I'm not even that. But like, I think that. You know, physical graffiti, right? This is like Kashmir alone, right? Come on, that makes that, you know, like that's worth the price of admission that the song Houses the Holy, right, from physical graffiti. And I'm actually a huge presence apologist. I think that like Achilles Last Stand is legitimately maybe like a top 10 Zeppelin track for me. So if you know, someday we can have a TIR GTA cross stream where we can hash all this out, but like I am gonna hold the line on that question.
We have
In Through the Outdoor kind of sucks. There's like one good track, but yeah.
Ben, have you seen the debate between Matt Brunig and Yaron Brook? It'd be a great debate breakdown.
I have not seen it. I was actually thinking I might. So Rob Larson has been coming on, I mean, unless he has a time conflict, of course, every second Thursday of the month to do a breakdown. So I was actually thinking about next time Rob is going to be on, seeing if he wants to do that one. That seems like it could be a good Rob Larson debate. I think the people who organized that also reached out to me about doing something. I don't know. Originally, it was going to be about like housing policy. And I was basically like, well, look, I've expressed opinions about them and I'm willing to defend those opinions, but like, I'm also not going to pretend to be any kind of deep expert. And so it might be a sort of broader thing about socialism, but anyway, whatever, whoever it's with it. And you know, like, I hope that does happen. Seems like a good platform, but, yeah. Oh my God. And I was being reminded of this. We do have a couple of, actually, I know we've, if you're doing these in order, I'll just skip to this. Cause while we're doing the music stuff,
sure.
Strom asked, Robert Johnson or Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson. I mean, obviously you can't go wrong either way. Right. But like, I'm a huge Robert Johnson fan. I think like, you know, it's just, I don't know what it is, but, this is, I actually remember many years ago when I was living in South Korea, being in an expat bar where like the music was controlled from like a customer facing computer. So you could just like walk up and change it and getting into this like huge fight with somebody, about, somebody at the expat bar in Korea about how, cause they were trying to remember, it was like a Robert Johnson song, Traveling Riverside Blues, there's like an Robert Johnson version of it. And there's like a Zeppelin cover on the BBC Sessions, I think. And they were like, we're going to listen to this. We should listen to the Zeppelin. And this was like the only context in which I would want to listen to not Zeppelin. So it's like, no, come on. Right. You know, if Jimmy Page were with us here, he'd say, listen to the Robert Johnson version of it. Let's listen to that. But yeah, I think that I mean, like Me and the Devil Blues, you know, I love that song. That's the one of the, they're like three competing Robert Johnson gravesite. It's a little unclear where he's buried, but the one that RCA picked to like pay for a big expensive tombstone on has, I think it's from that song, right? That's the, it's either that or how it, where he says there's the, you know, it has the quote from the lyrics, you know, when I die, you can lay my body down by the highway side. And I always thought it's hilarious. They don't quote the next line, which is so my old evil spirit can get on a Greyhound bus and ride. But yeah, I have, like I said, I'm not going to claim that this is like some objective quality based thing, but for me, Robert Johnson.
All right. We think we have time for a couple more, two or three more.
Let's do a few more.
I was going to continue going in order. Did you have one?
Oh yeah. Sorry. Just to make sure we got to it while we were doing all the music stuff. There was somewhere I saw, I'm trying to find the original thing. Jack Malone says, thoughts on Dio era of Black Sabbath. I actually really enjoy Dio solo, but I'm not the biggest fan of Dio Sabbath. Like I love Ozzy era Sabbath. Like, you know, the original Black Sabbath record, you know, I love Volume 4. I think that's like a really good and really interesting and just fun album. Paranoid, right? At the risk of sounding like Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force, right? It's like every time somebody brings up a band, you know, on the show, it's like, oh yeah, I saw them in Madison Square Gardens and, you know, 1985, they rocked, right? But like, I remember seeing the Black Sabbath during the Black Sabbath reunion tour with Ozzy, that I went to see that in West Pompano Beach in 2013. And I remember, you know, we got there a little late. So I remember just like getting out of the car and hearing the sort of those sort of opening chords of War Pigs, be like, oh, this just makes me so happy right now. I know Jason's a huge fan. Like Jason likes Dio era Sabbath a lot. But you know, maybe I'm just too focused on the other Sabbath that I like more, but you know, I never got that much into it. But like, look, I mean, if you're gonna, you know, I mean, this is nothing against Roddy James Dio, right? I mean, if you're gonna, you know, like put, you know, Rainbow in the Dark or something on the radio, I will be, you know, I will be enthusiastic and possibly even sing along off key for some of it.
Okay. I'm sure this will be a quick answer. Hopping in a Wayback Machine, what advice would you give Carl Liebknecht?
Oh, Jesus.
It's not a closing out the show, easy type of question, but I briefly put it on the screen, so I didn't want to, you know.
Fair enough. Well, look, I mean, I think that I can understand why they wanted to grab their chance, but I think that the Spartacus uprising was premature, which is actually what I guess I'm less sure about Liebknecht, but I know is what Rosa Luxemburg actually argued within the party. She got outvoted. And you know, look, clearly she was right. Right. Like this is, and it's a huge historic loss. The best of the German far left was killed and went to prison in other cases. If Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht had stayed alive, would the KPD, right, the German Communist Party, have like gone Stalinist in the same way? Would that have been like a useful opposition force, you know, like what difference could it have made to, you know, I mean, like if they'd tried it, you know, if you had like this powerful rising force in German politics, in the sort of original better version, you know, with the Nazis have still happened. I mean, obviously it's totally unknowable, but yeah. I don't know. I guess my advice is a time traveler told me this was a really, really bad idea and we shouldn't do it. We shouldn't do it right now. That, you know, that would be my suggestion for what Carl Liebknecht should say about at the party meeting where they were arguing about whether to do the uprising at that time.
All right. A couple more question. How come campism isn't levied as a corrective on the left more often?
I don't know. Should be. I think when people talk about campism, I think they're roughly talking about like the idea that, you know, we should like root for whatever countries or forces are sort of aligned against, you know, the American Empire, which I think is often a bad idea because, you know, this is I find that the insight that more than one thing at a time can be bad can like really take you a long way.
Yeah. People really struggle with that one. I've seen it firsthand. All right. Let's see. From Paul Fletcher question, Nathan Robinson said that he took on board your approach when debating Destiny, Mr. Borelli, as Norman called him. What advice would you give when debating creatures such as Destiny, etc.?
Yeah. We actually did talk about it a bit before his debate, and I mean, I think just see if you can slow him down, right? Because I think a lot of times his impulse is to Steven, if you're watching this if this gets clipped eventually and you watch it on your stream, you know, I'm not, you know, using any insults here. But yeah, I think his instinct a lot of times is to talk really fast and throw out a bunch of factual claims at the same time. And then get into these, like when one of them is challenged, get into these like rabbit holes where you go back and forth about this one really specific factual claim and split hairs really finely. And it becomes really, really easy to miss the forest for the trees, right? That, because I would just try to, I think this is kind of what I said. I mean, just kind of try to focus on the sort of core points of principle that I don't really care who said what after the Peel Commission plan, although that was actually kind of in a very horrible black comedy kind of way, a funny moment in the debate because, you know, Destiny was like, oh, you know, what about the Arabs rejecting the Peel Commission partition plan in 1936, or whatever. It's like, yeah, wouldn't that have involved like actually transferring a bunch of people off their land? So isn't that violence? And he kind of said, oh, well, maybe you could do it nonviolently, which, man, good luck with that. But I think that it doesn't really matter that much who said what about the Peel Commission, what exactly happened at, you know, Camp David and Taba and, you know, Madrid and Oslo and, you know, and what exactly the sequence of events was, you know, leading up to the war in 1967 and all this stuff that, like, I think you could really get lost in that and miss the sort of core point, which to my mind is just, is it okay to treat human beings this way? Right? That like, can you, is it okay to rule over millions of people for 57 years and not give them citizenship in your state, for example? Right. And I think that's like a much more interesting argument than trying to like lawyer the details of what happened at what diplomatic summit when, you know, that would definitely be my suggestion about that.
Okay. I think we basically actually have one more. So, and it's a substantive one, which is always, I mean, all of them have been substantive, but you know, this is really in your wheelhouse, Ben, about different translations of capital. So question, Michael Heinrich, says there is another translation of capital, not the Princeton, based on the addition of the recently deceased Thomas Kaczynski. Do you have any information about this? Corey Robin talking about a new translation?
I know I remember seeing Corey had posted, so is this, So yeah, I guess I'm not totally clear. They said not the Princeton, so I'm not sure which one's the Princeton, which one's the one this person's talking about. So because I just don't see, like, I didn't see a publisher name on the cover of the proof that he posted.
Okay.
But so it might or might not be the same one they're thinking of. But I saw the Corey Robbins stuff about whichever one of the forthcoming editions this was, and that looked really interesting, right? Like that, you know, I mean, it's not going to change that, you know, much, right? I mean, for obvious reasons, right? You know, like, but yeah, it did look like some of the translation choices were interestingly different. You know, the Wendy Brown introduction. Yeah, sorry, I'm just trying to figure out which edition is which here. But like that he talked about in that one, did look like it was going to be, you know, like I find her interesting, and I obviously comes from a very different tradition, but like I think she often has interesting things to say, right? You know, so it's like that one I was officially kind of psyched about. If the whatever Heinrich is talking about is different, I might not be familiar with it, but I'm not sure. I also saw a while ago that there was a here, let me see if I can find this. So it was, yeah, here we go. Can you spend the next hour explaining the true class nature of the USSR? No. All right, moving on.
Ben, we discussed how I have yet another cold and I'm sick, and Ben's like, no, don't worry, it's gonna be a light show. You know, I'm sure you could make it. And then Ben just keeps me here until like midnight, explaining, you know, going, you know, sentence by sentence on different translations of Capital and explaining the class nature of the USSR. No, well, we might have to tackle it.
No, I'm not. I will answer that question in the spirit which was asked and just leave it at no. Yeah. Okay. Last two things, I guess, if that's probably it for questions for today. If we did miss you, I'm sorry. It wasn't on purpose. But I guess last two things before we go are Andy, do you want to do a plug the Smith College thing?
Yeah, right now, this is actually kind of exciting. The students at Smith College, which is an all women's school, very, very well known. If you know, like the history of feminism and stuff like that, it kind of like started there, more or less. A bunch of students have gathered in one of the administration buildings and has held it since Wednesday. Ben remembers I was like DMing him like while I'm trying to figure out while I'm wandering around in the dark on this campus trying to find this building. but they've held the building since Wednesday, so it's been like 6 days. Democracy Now! This morning actually mentioned one line about it, you know, during their big plugs. But I've been in communication with a couple of the students that are involved with this, and they asked me to make sure that y'all sign the petition that they have out there, which is a big ask that they're doing. Basically, the petition says that the whole reason why they're holding this building hostage is that they want the school to divest from military contractors. Apparently, Smith's invested in like a Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and a few others. They want the school to divest. While they're there, they're also, you know, when they had a meeting with the college said that the community does not support what the students are doing. And that's bullshit. I'm sorry, this community, you know, yes, there are people who disagree, I'm sure. Sure. Absolutely, because every community is diverse like that. But the community in general, I think is behind it once you actually talk about, you know, what they're actually trying to do. And So they're asking to sign the petition to let them know that. Also, part of the petition is also demanding that a member of the faculty who assaulted one of the students has a hearing held sure. about his behavior. And asking that the students who are involved with this take over the building, which, by the way, today they were flying the Palestinian flag above the building, which is exciting. they're asking to not to have any disciplinary charges against any of the people involved with occupying the building.
Nice. Yeah. So we have the link to that petition in the description down below the boxes where you're watching us right now. Speaking of Palestine stuff, I did tease these things earlier, so I'll do both of them just very quickly because this is already later than we thought the show was going to go tonight. So, because there were a lot of good questions, mostly. Mostly because there are a lot of good questions. I'm not like shitting on some of the questions, like mostly good questions. Mostly because of that, partially for other reasons, but, in any case, a couple weeks ago, we did the, time's a flat circle, whatever, but they have we had Nathan Robinson on to talk about his Destiny debate. And he did actually end up writing a really good article for Current Affairs about that called My Date with Destiny. And this is really, to my mind, I mean, this is Nathan at his best. It's very thoughtful. He says, I think some very true things about what he doesn't like about that style of debate at the beginning, but then he really goes through, like, he's like, look, a lot of this stuff and this kind of snappy back and forth can get lost, but, he goes through a lot of the key points from the debate and, you know, Destiny sort of doing, I don't know that I believe that thing about food shortages in Gaza that, it's like, oh, people are always saying they're on the brink of famine, whatever. And he goes through a lot of, you know, really heartbreaking details about that. He goes through a lot of, he has very thoughtful things to say about the apartheid stuff. And anyway, it's a really good article. I cannot recommend that enough. Go read that. Even if you don't care about Destiny or this debate or whatever, it'll make you much better informed about this stuff in a very accessible way. I also feel like this is something you could show somebody who was not on the same page and it might actually make them think.
And Nathan's a great writer too, so you're not wasting your time.
Yeah, exactly. The only other thing, I know Andy has one more thing, but yeah, before that, this is, I don't know. Do you want to take a minute on the Brianna follow-up or should we just push that back? We did have, so this was the original thing, right? That they have a, the other yesterday, right? I tweeted this kind of thing I'd say, right? I will never understand and do not want to understand the mental lives of people who can read about the record number of quote pediatric amputations unquote going on in Gaza right now and still think, well, this is very complicated, capital V, capital C. Let's not try to form any harsh or extreme judgments. Brianna Wu, who of course I'd also had on recently to argue with me about this stuff, took this as, I don't know if she thought I was subtweeting her in particular, or she just saw herself in it and so she pushed back. By the way, apparently if you're willing to pay for Twitter, like, you can just put fucking War and Peace in there. Like, this is, it's amazing to me that this is all one tweet, but anyway,
It's also the literature equivalent of Tolstoy.
Yes, has all the literary merits of Tolstoy.
This is really the modern War and Peace.
Exactly. Sure. Why not?
Are we reading this whole thing, or are we just?
I don't know if we're going to get to the end, but at least read the first, couple thousand words of
Rihanna it. Rihanna says, "It's not that we think it's very complicated. Everyone decent wants this hard end. Free Palestine types do not have a moral monopoly on wanting civilians and especially children to be safe. It's that we're looking at the facts and drawing wildly different conclusions about A, who is responsible, and B, who is standing in the way of peace. I've listened to your arguments. You blame Israel and Biden. I think that's a divorce from reality because I can point to countless articles showing Hamas are rejecting the ceasefire proposals and Hamas started this war. Trust building measures. Also, I didn't raise my voice, but the last two things were in all caps.
All caps.
Trust building measures to de-escalate is the only way forward, which should start by Hamas accepting the trade of 800 prisoners for 40 hostages, a fantastic deal for them. But don't kid yourself. Hamas started this fight. Hamas made the choice to operate from hospitals, mosques, and schools, making them legitimate military targets under international law. And Hamas are the ones leaving their civilians living in tents. Out of fever delusion.
Yeah, all right. I think we've got it right. Anybody who's curious about the whole thing can pause the image at this point. Which I have to say, this really, I will admit, as far as sort of general emotional tenor here, that I've been trying to do this thing lately where I like stow away my phone and computer overnight, and so I like don't touch them until I've like done a bunch of other things in the morning, just for general mental health reasons. And so when I got my phone and computer out, I've been up for a couple hours, but it was like the first thing I saw when I was like, okay. I won't run through everything I said in response, but this is, I described this as complete nonsense and went on to say, I think there's, a certain disconnect here between, well, I listened to your arguments and I'm not convinced. Like, well, I don't know. My memory of that debate was very different. I remember a lot of, sort of shocked face and wow, when I said anything that, that seems extreme from the perspective of bipartisan U.S. consensus. I remember a lot fewer responses to specific arguments, like that point earlier about like, okay, is there any, like something I think I said a few times over the course of the debate, is there anything that could be true about what had happened at this or that diplomatic summit that would make it okay to rule over millions of people for 57 years without making them citizens of your state? And I don't know. That was a point I returned to a bunch of times. I really didn't hear a response to it. I heard a lot of, oh, you support right of return. Wow. Right. It's like, it's like, oh, I can't believe you're admitting to holding this extremist position. And, and then the other points, made there is, the U.S. has vetoed lots of ceasefire resolutions, and the idea that the clock starts on the on October 7th. I think that I would maybe describe as divorced from reality, because October 7th is certainly a horrible thing, but it's one event in a very long cycle of attacks and counterattacks and atrocities and counter atrocities. In terms of the overall death count, as grim as it is, right, the 695 civilians, that's the Israeli estimate from October 7th. That's not nearly as many civilians as many other incidents in this long cycle of atrocities and counter atrocities. Protective Edge, when Israel was bombing Gaza in 2014, killed thousands of civilians. Right now, tens of thousands of civilians have been killed, and millions have been displaced, etc. None of this is to say that October 7th is okay. It's never okay to intentionally attack civilians, but sort of saying that's the inciting incident, as if that just came out of nowhere, I think is crazy.
But then under the same logic, then, sorry, but then based on what Israel's done, if you start the clock now, Gaza could do, if you, you know, multiply the civilian count, death count in Palestine, or I mean, divide that by the amount of people that, you know, died on October 7th, they could do that many times magnitude order worse to Israel, and it would be justified by the same logic, right? If you just start going back and forth on, because X many people are killed, we can kill even way more. It's just, it's not really a logic. I mean, then she starts opining on, oh, this is how we get peace. You know what I mean? But I think that, because you know, it's just blaming everything on Hamas as opposed to taking, you know, a real look at what would require any sort of peace. So it's just kind of a violent logic that is.
No, exactly, and it's like, look, how's that going, right? I mean, because it's like the same basic approach. This is like the most extreme version of it, right? Since 1948 itself in many ways, right? But like in but how's that been going, right? I mean, is that sort of like is this kind of sadistic collective vengeance, which again, this is a very extreme iteration of, but I mean, this is basically how Israel has, you know, has acted consistently in the past. Has that been leading to peace? Doesn't seem like we've run the experiment, right? And it does not actually lead to that result. And then, yeah, I guess after the screenshot cuts off, I'd also said that, again, to me, like, even if those last two points were false, even if, let's say, you know, Israel was minding its own business and, you know, Hamas attacked on October 7th out of nowhere. That was the inciting incident, right? That's where we should start the clock. Even if that were true, and even if, you know, Hamas was the main obstacle to various ceasefire proposals, as opposed to mostly we've had months of, you know, Israel opposing and the U.S. vetoing, you know, ceasefire proposals. But even if that were all true, right? Even if both of those premises were true, okay. It's still not okay to drop bombs that you know are going to dismember children, right? That there's nothing that would justify that, right? Certainly, like, nothing that could possibly be going on at any ceasefire negotiation could justify that. You know, if you have like a, you know, serial killer who's dismembering children, they said they'll stop when their demands are met, right? Like, no details about what's happening in the negotiations to meet the demands could justify what they're doing, right? I think we can just leave that as a categorical imperative and just skip the rest of this stuff. I don't understand. I mean, I'll go back to what I said in the original tweet that, you know, that she was responding to, right? I don't understand what's going on in the mind of anybody who can sort of see nuance and whether it's okay to do things that, you know, are going to dismember children. And I kind of don't want to know. I think I'm much happier not understanding that. All right. I know that's a huge downer.
I'm going to bring it down a little bit more. A comic book artist that I used to follow until came out, there was a bunch of allegations about him actually grooming children. But he committed suicide. I found out right before he went on air. And I just want to put this out there. If you are suffering, you know, if you're feeling, you know, if you feel like you need help, call. There, help is not that far away. You can call or even text 988 from your cell phone, and you can get some help, or call 1-800-273-8255. So please, if you're in a place like that, reach out. Somebody will help, because people do care about you.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Well, the tone transition has not been invented.
I was on mute. I said on a positive note, I was trying to handle that transition, but no, thank you. Thank you, Andy. That's very true. We try to create a positive community over here. All are what. So on that note, I think we had a lot of awesome questions today. Thanks for bearing with our bit. We put some effort into it. Thanks for bearing with our April Fool's joke. Mercrucio says thank you GTA for a fun, entertaining AMA stream based on that exciting announcement earlier. Here's wishing your channel the absolute best. I saw some people say I missed the announcement. So the announcement was a very special April Fool's announcement that we are joining the Daily Wire Network. An April Fool's announcement, just in case it couldn't be any more clear.
It did occur to me. It's like, man, if we actually managed to like really pull this off and like keep straight faces for like enough minutes at the beginning of the stream, it like, am I gonna like log on to Twitter and see like breathless, you know?
No matter how ridiculous you try to make it, I think that there will be people whose confirmation bias are strong enough that, like you said, they would believe anything you said, that any right-wing turn that you said, they would say. We were just waiting. Post-left watch or whatever would immediately pick it up.
Yeah, post-left watch, Matthew Dimitri. That was the, yeah, totally. That's... No, it's, I will be, I expect that like when I'm asking the nice young man at the nursing home to like help me with my webcam so I can do the show, I expect there will still be people being like, I'll give it another year. And like, Ben's going to charge the right, you know, yeah,
the nice young man will be me, by the way.
Yeah. You know, once you get to that age, a few years makes a big difference.
Yeah. I'll be 90 and Ben will be 100. Knock on wood. All right. Well, what do you say, Ben?
Yeah, let's call it a night. We are gonna have Jay Ponte on next week. We'll do a full episode, post game, whole thing. I believe. Still have to double check with both of the guys that they're up for this, but I believe Victor and Ethan are going to be back on Thursday for the part two of the debate breakdown that we were doing last Thursday. So there is definitely stuff coming up. We can smuggle a phone into that building at Smith College at some point. And have a hear directly on the show or some stream from one or more of them at some point. So lots of good stuff coming up. But we are on that note going to call it a night for tonight. Left is best.